is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, hoop heads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish home machine. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Sean McDonald, boys varsity basketball coach at University School in Cleveland, Ohio. You're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering new subscribers 10% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code SAVE10 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
Coaches, do you have a point guard or leader you're going to be counting on next season to run the show for you? Don't leave next season to chance. Thousands of coaches send their players to a point guard college camp each summer to learn to think the game, lead a team, and run the show. Your players will be smarter, better leaders, and better equipped to foster a championship culture next season in practice and in your locker room. I've seen firsthand how PGC camps have had a huge impact on players and coaches that I know, both on and off the court. You can go to pgcbasketball.com to find a 5-day, 4-night camp near you. That's pgcbasketball.com.
In the talent development journey, the players are going to have to take ownership of their own development. And so if that never happens, you're unlikely to reach a very high level of success.
Ryan McCormick, PhD, is a professional basketball coach, consultant, and clinician. McCormick has coached professionally in Denmark, Ireland, and Sweden, taking a team to the finals in Denmark's first division and being selected to coach in a Swedish All-Star game. He has coached CYO, AAU, high school, junior college, and college basketball in the Western United States, and worked as a strength and conditioning coach for 2 junior college basketball programs. McCormick has directed clinics in Canada, China, Greece, Ghana, India, Macedonia, Trinidad and Tobago, and throughout the United States, and spoken at coaching, strength and conditioning, and sports psychology conferences in the U.S. and Canada. McCormick completed his PhD in exercise and sports science at the University of Utah and has had peer-reviewed papers published in the International Journal of Exercise Science, International Journal of Sports Science and Coaching, and Strength and Conditioning Journal. Ryan is the author of numerous books, including The 21st Century Basketball Practice, Fake Fundamentals, and 180 Shooter. If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at Hoopheads Pod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Have your notebook handy as you listen to this episode with Coach Brian McCormick, author of The 21st Century Basketball Practice. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here tonight with my co-host Jason Sunkel, and we are pleased to welcome to the podcast Brian McCormick, basketball coach, author, and a guy who has a lot
of interesting thoughts about the way that we go about coaching the game of basketball. Brian, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. We are excited to be able to have you on and dig into some of the things that you have shared through your writing, through your work with other coaches and consulting and online. So excited to be able to get into some of those things with you. Want to go back in time to start off when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about your first experiences with the game of basketball and just what drew you into the game and made it something that you knew you were going to fall in love with.
I mean, we started playing, you know, on the playground, you know, at recess and stuff like that. I didn't join a team until fifth grade. You know, I went to a Catholic elementary school. So we had sports at our school. You know, basketball started in fifth grade. You know, we had a JV and then we had varsity in seventh and eighth grade. So it was really, it was the first sport that we could play for our school. You know, so I played soccer and I played baseball before that. But so basketball, we really started just kind of, you know, playing at recess. And then, you know, I got a hoop sometime, you know, like a Christmas present, you know, probably when I was like 8 or 9 years old or something like that. You know, so I'd shoot on my own, you know, mainly, and then just playing at school, recess and stuff like that. And then, the summer before, fifth grade, you know, in anticipation of playing on a team, I went to my first camp. I went to the Terry Tyler basketball camp. Terry Tyler, the old NBA player, actually lived in the house behind me, in my neighborhood. His son was like, I think 2 years younger than me. But so there were two girls who lived across the street from me. One was my age and one was a couple years older and they played. And so I think my mom put me in that camp so she could carpool, you know, with them, cause it was at the local junior college. So, you know, these days I would think that the drive was nothing, but that back then it was like a 20 or 30 minute drive, which I thought was, you know, a whole different city. You know, so we could carpool with the girls across the street and stuff. So that was kind of the first time that I'd played organized basketball, and then, you know, playing, you know, PAL basketball. And our team ended up, you know, being pretty good, you know, in sixth and eighth grade. And then I went on to high school and played a little bit in high school. And, you know, sophomore year on the JV, I got hurt. That's kind of when I started coaching. You know, my dad had been my coach in fifth to eighth grade for basketball. My dad was a pretty good player when he was younger. And then, so he coached us along with a couple other dads. And then when I got hurt, when I was a sophomore, he was helping coach one of his friends' team. Actually, we were talking about it this weekend because the friend was Mr. Schubert. Carl Schubert, and his son was just Court Schubert was on the team. He was put in the California Berkeley Athletic Hall of Fame because he was a national team rugby player. So we were talking, reminiscing about the days of coaching that. So that was kind of the first time that I went out and coached a little bit, you know, going out after my practices and stuff, you know, when I was injured. And basically I started coaching from there. You know, I still played, but I didn't play again for my high school. I played again after high school as an exchange student in Sweden. And so I played for the team in my town there, you know, like under 20s or under 19s. And then basically the same team was like the second division men's team. You know, so I played in that. But I stayed coaching and kind of been coaching on and off ever since.
What did you like about coaching right out of the gate?
I kind of always wanted to be a coach. You know, I was kind of, you know, the kid who was always, you know, the captain. You know, when we picked teams at recess and stuff, I was always like the captain and always, you know, telling other kids what to do and, you know, probably bossing kids around. And, you know, I was the one like you know, that would pay attention to the rules and would know, you know, would argue about the rules and stuff like that. So I remember I did in like whatever third grade or whenever you do your first book report, I did my first book report on They Call Me Coach by John Wooden. And so I think between my dad being my coach, you know, and then reading that book, and my dad was a, you know, big UCLA, you know, fan and Wooden fan and stuff like that. So, you know, I kind of always figured that I wanted to be a coach. You know, I just kind of assumed that I'd be a coach like, you know, my dad. I'd have a job and you know, just kind of coach on the side or whatever. You know, I never imagined the things that I've done. I didn't even know things like that were possible when I was young. I just always kind of imagined that I would be a coach just because, you know, that's what my dad did. And, you know, my dad, you know, he wanted to be a coach. He wanted to be like a teacher and a coach. And, you know, at that time, you know, once he got married and had kids and stuff, he realized that that probably wasn't going to be a way to, you know, make a really good living. And so that's why he kind of went into business. But, you know, I always got the sense that, you know, he really enjoyed the coaching and stuff. And so, you know, I think I was always kind of thinking in that direction in some way.
What part of coaching do you feel like at the beginning you were pretty good at that you took to naturally? Was there some aspect of the coaching profession or the process of coaching that you thought right from the beginning, hey, I'm pretty good at this piece of it?
I mean, not really. I mean, I started coaching, you know, when I was 16 years old. so, I mean, what I was good at, you know, probably was just, you know, being able to communicate, you know, with the players and, you know, have that understanding of what they're probably not understanding. I remember my senior year of high school, I actually helped coach the freshman team at my high school. And, you know, one of the dads, or maybe it was even the boy on the team, you know, he told me at the end of the season, he's like, man, you know, I don't know if my son would have even, you know, made it through this year of high school, you know, without you as his coach. You know, you just really helped him, you know, acclimate and feel comfortable and stuff like that, both on and off the court. So, you know, at that time, you know, that's probably mostly, you know, what I did. I think, you know, I always watched a lot of basketball and, you know, I probably had a decent, you know, especially for that time. I mean, you know, back then, you know, nobody was, you know, reading books or going on websites. There wasn't YouTube. There weren't, you know, 100 courses you could take and Instagram and stuff like that. So, you know, basically most of the learning was based on what you had done as a player or maybe what you were, you know, seeing on television. And I think I had a decent acumen for taking things that I saw, you know, off TV and having an idea of, you know, simplifying it a certain way that we could actually use some of the stuff, you know, with our teams, you know, something like that, you know, cause like I grew up as, you know, all our teams, fifth to eighth grade, all we did was ever run like flex offense and stuff like that. You know, which as players, we always hated. And, you know, I mean, part of why, so we used to always just try to fast break so we didn't have to run the flex. Cause you know, for us, it was all, you know, oh, well, you know, we just have to kind of follow directions and whatever. We just wanted to play like we played when we were, you know, at recess and stuff like that. And so, you know, we played together so much at recess and, you know, back then, you know, our coaches wanted to win and stuff, but nothing like they weren't as, you know, crazy as coaches today. You know, so, I mean, and it seems commonplace now because we see it more, but back then it was, you know, much different. Like I remember, you know, being in a whatever sixth or seventh grade basketball game and throwing, you know, behind the back passes or going, you know, behind the back You know, back then it was like, you know, some coaches were, you know, you can't do that. That's just, you're just showing up the other team and stuff like that. And, you know, like I said, now it's commonplace. And it's not a big deal if a seventh grader can go behind his back or throwing around the back pass or something like that. But back then, like, it was unusual, and it was things that we could do because we did it, you know, we played, you know, on our own at recess. It wasn't things we, you know, really did during practice or anything like that. But so then when I started coaching, like I had a decent idea of how to not rely on the flex offense and try to, you know, kind of implement, you know, very basic things that, you know, I probably picked off television.
So compare and contrast the way that you feel like you grew up in the game and learned the game compared to the way that kids who come up in the US-based travel basketball system, just in general, obviously there are variations, but when you think about the way you grew up in the game versus the way a kid who kind of follows the traditional path of today's youth player, what's different about the experiences that you had versus the experiences that a kid has today? And then we can kind of get into what are the benefits and negatives of each of those two systems.
I think the biggest change is for us, it was, you know, we played on our own before we ever joined a team. So it was always, it was always something that was, you know, a player or child initiated. You know, now, you know, children start at such a young age that, you know, they can't really make that choice. Like I don't remember making a conscious choice to join a little league team when I was 6 years old or the youth soccer team, you know, when I was 6 or 7 years old, whatever it was. Like, I don't remember making that choice. I don't remember asking my mom if I could play soccer, asking if I could play baseball. I'm pretty sure that, you know, they saw a sign up somewhere. You know, I started in soccer at my church. So I'm sure, you know, there was something in like the church bulletin or whatever about, hey, we have, you know, a soccer team, you know, you can sign up for it, you know, and that's probably how I signed up for it. I don't think, you know, cause I mean, especially back then, like soccer wasn't on TV. I didn't know what soccer was until, you know, I showed up at a practice, you know, and really didn't know what soccer was until probably sixth or seventh grade after playing for 5 or 6 years. You know, baseball was a little different cause at least it was on television. And, you know, by the time I started, I'd probably gone to a baseball game. You know, I probably went to a Giants or an A's game, probably a Giants game, you know, when I was about that age, you know, five, six or seven years old is when I probably went to my first Major League Baseball game. So, you know, I'd seen it, it's on TV, you know, the World Series, you know, if nothing else. So, you know, so maybe I asked if I could play Little League, but I'm pretty sure it was the same thing. My parents just, you know, that's what you did. You know, you play sports. So, you know, where can we sign up our son for sports? Whereas basketball, that, you know, I mean, there may have been leagues, but nobody I knew played in them at that age. And so it was something that we create, you know, we started on our own, and then it was something that we could look forward to. Okay. Well, when we get to be in fifth grade, we get to play on a team, you know? And so we had those, you know, I think we probably started in second grade or third grade. I know we were playing in third grade, but maybe as early as second grade, we were, you know, shooting around and playing at recess. So, you know, we had a good 2-3 years of playing before we ever got on the team, you know, where we could make that kind of decision. Yeah, I want to play basketball. You know, I really enjoy this. And we messed around and we, you know, learned through our own mistakes and stuff like that. Whereas now, you know, children are put on teams when they're, you know, 6-7 years old. And like I said, with me and with baseball and soccer, it's probably not really their own choice. Their parents are probably putting them on teams because they think it's good for them, or they don't want them to fall behind, or, you know, whatever the reasons, you know, which all have merit that parents have for putting their children in sports. But it becomes a, you know, parent initiated activity. And then typically the practices and games are all coach driven. And so, you know, to me, everything else that's different about the system starts with that idea is that, you know, for us, it was all intrinsically motivated and child-centered, you know, for the first 2 or 3 years before we even joined a team, you know, whereas today most everything starts off from the beginning as a adult initiated activity and generally with, you know, kind of extrinsic or external motivation. And I just think that sets the stage for all the other various differences and changes that we see, you know, in the game, you know, for children of today versus, you know, a generation or two ago.
How does that constrain the development in your mind of a young basketball player? So I'm a kid who's 7 or 8 years old, and going back 25 or 30 years ago, I'm just out on the driveway or I'm in the park with my friends and I'm playing, I'm experimenting, I'm doing different things, I'm trying stuff. Versus I always feel like you put a kid today in a game at age 7 or 8 and somebody's in the stands, a coach is telling them what to do, there's a scoreboard, people are watching. And I always feel like it just constrains a kid's ability to try different things. Because if people are watching, you're going to kind of default to what's easy or what you do well. And so can you speak a little bit to the maybe the creativity in the game that's been lost because we put kids into organized games far too fast and they don't get that opportunity for free play?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, when we're at recess or whatever, you know, it's a much more, like I said, it's a much more child initiated activity, more freedom, creativity. You know, there's no real right or wrong. You know, nobody told us not to shoot 3-pointers until we got to a team, you know, in 5th or 6th grade. And then our coaches told us not to shoot 3-pointers. You know, when we were at recess, we did whatever we wanted. You know, so I definitely agree with that. But then I would also say the counter to that is that players today, you know, have the ability to do far more, you know, creative and skillful things than most players, you know, when I was playing, you know, and you know, just because once you got on a team, at, you know, whenever you started fourth, fifth, sixth grade, you know, most of the things were then discouraged. So we, you know, had some ability to do different things because we had, you know, made them up on our own, you know, but then once we got a team, it was, no, you can't do that. And, you know, back then, you know, it was definitely, you know, my way or the highway with coaches and, you know, most of the time things were discouraged. You know, so it was, you know, different, you know, than today where things that would have seemed like an anomaly, or like I said, you know, you were showing up the other team because you threw an around the back pass. You know, now nobody would even look twice if a 10-year-old throws an around the back pass, you know, in a game, in an organized game. Whereas like when that, if that happened, you know, when I was young, like, you know, the game would stop. You're like, what's going on? you know, like this is the greatest 10-year-old in the history of basketball, you know? So, you know, it's just different. So I mean, you know, I agree. I think the big thing in terms of long-term retention in the game is when you start and everything's child initiated and it's, you know, intrinsically motivated, that it comes from within. And so it becomes something that, you know, eventually I made that choice to play. Whereas soccer or baseball, like I said, I never really made that choice to play. You know, and as a consequence, you know, when I did join a team in basketball, you know, I was more motivated to practice things on my own, and to try to improve and to, you know, try to play better and earn more playing time and win more games and, you know, whatever the kind of external things are. Whereas in soccer or baseball, I never kind of had that desire. And, you know, maybe it's just, you know, my dad was more of a basketball guy than soccer or baseball. So maybe it was all just because, you know, of my dad, you know, even though I don't think he really pushed me, you know, hard into sports or anything like that, but maybe it was just knowing that, you know, he liked basketball and basketball was kind of the sport that he enjoyed the most. And, you know, I mean, he'd never played soccer, you know, and he was a decent baseball player, but, you know, basketball was definitely the sport, you know, that we enjoyed the most. So it could be, you know, something as simple as that. And I'm just kind of, you know, looking back and attributing it to something else. You know, and I think, you know, obviously the true answer is probably it's all of the above. But, you know, I do think that that is the concern, with putting children into sports too early. And especially once the sports get competitive too early, is that, you know, like you said, there's kind of the, I think it's the social inhibition theory, you know, that you're going to do what you can, that what you're already successful at in front of an audience, you know, and things like that, but, or social facilitation theory, Zajonic's social facilitation theory, I believe. So, you know, that's definitely a concern and things like that. But I think a lot of it just stems from that initial motivation and how that just changes our approach and how we feel towards, you know, the sporting landscape or the environment.
Yeah, it's so true. That intrinsic motivation, I think that's something that if you don't learn it as a coach or you don't kind of realize it in your own journey as a player, I think for those of us that are out there that are parents, I think you come to realize very, very quickly that if your child is not intrinsically motivated in whatever it is, it could be basketball, but it could be playing the piano or it could be art or whatever. If you are providing those opportunities for your kid to try those things, and then you're having to drag them to those events or those activities, we all know that your ability to achieve in that area where it's parent driven as opposed to child driven, you're never going to achieve what you hope to achieve. Or as a parent, your child is never going to hope what you achieve, what you hope they can achieve, if it's coming from you as the parent, as opposed to coming from within the child.
Right. At some point in the, you know, talent development journey, the player's going to have to take, or the athlete's going to have to take ownership of their own development. And so if that never happens, you know, you're unlikely to reach a very high level of success. You know, like you said, I remember when I started doing a little bit of private training, you know, I realized basically private training was there so that, cause parents knew that their child needed to practice more, but they also knew that they lived, you know, busy lives, and the easiest thing to, eliminate would be, you know, taking their child to the park just to let them shoot on their own for a half hour or an hour. But if they had a appointment where they're working with a trainer and they were paying for that trainer and that trainer was going to charge them whether they showed up or not, then they would make sure that they were there for that hour. And so it was less, I think personal trainers, you know, oftentimes that's really what a personal trainer is there for, you know, people, you know, in a gym or whatever, weight loss, you know, or just to get in shape. It's to hold you accountable for being there. But, you know, to be truly successful, you can't rely on that appointment to hold you successful. You have to be the one to initiate that, you know? And that doesn't mean that it's necessarily wrong. It doesn't mean that you have to make that decision at 8 years old, that you're going to take ownership of your own development. But somewhere in that journey, somewhere, you know, probably in the early teens, you definitely have to make that choice and say, yeah, this is something that's important to me, and I'm going to take ownership of what I'm doing, and I'm going to, you know, start working out more. I'm going to ask my parents to take me here. I want, you know, I'm going to ask for a trainer because I think it'll help me, or I'm going to ask for a hoop in my backyard, or, you know, whatever the case may be. I remember the legend of this kid. He never mounted anything because he didn't have any grades. But I just remember everybody always talked about this guy, who was, I think he was probably 2 years ahead of me. And kind of the legend that, you know, that he would go to the playground. He would walk to school at 6 a.m. and he would go to the playground. He would just play basketball. He would shoot for 2 hours out on the blacktop, before he went to school, you know. And like I said, nobody knows who he is anymore because, you know, he never even played in college because he didn't have any grades. So maybe you would have been better off spending those 2 hours in the library instead of shooting. But, you know, he wanted to play basketball and he made that choice. Like, nobody forced him to get up. Nobody took him there. Like, you know, he got up on his own. He walked to the court. He shot on his own. Nobody was there. And it was, you know, everybody always talked about that. But, you know, so at some point, if you want to be a really good player, you have to make that choice. And as long as it's, if you rely on it. And so to me, if you make that choice early to, you know, and you progress into a sport more gradually where, you know, yeah, I just play for fun. I play with my friends. I play in the neighborhood. And then, you know, I asked my, you know, third, fourth, fifth grade, hey, mom, dad, can I be on a team? Like, I've been playing basketball and it's really fun. I want to be on a team. I want to, you know, have a coach. I want to get better. You know, I think you're on the path to then saying when you're, you know, 12, 13, 14 years old, okay, I've been on a team, you know, I'm improving, but I really, really, you know, I want to make the varsity team. I want to play in college. I want to do this. You know, I need to work that much harder. Whereas if you start, you know, when you're 7 years old and your parent drives you and puts you there and then they drive you and they say you need a personal trainer. And so they take you to a personal trainer, you know, all you learn is to follow directions. And it's almost like you learn that sports are what you do when you have an appointment or when you have a practice, and you forget that you can do it on your own anytime you want. Like, you don't need that appointment to go out and shoot. You can walk to a court or ask for a ride to a court or take a bus or, you know, whatever. And you can get yourself to a court and you can practice on your own. You don't need to have that personal trainer there to get up shots, you know? And so I think that's one thing that gets forgotten when we just, you know, from the very beginning, everything becomes, you know, adult initiated. You know, I remember when I first wrote Crossover, you know, people would, they're like, you know, this is great, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I started to try to listen to what you're saying. And I just put the ball out and told my players, you know, to play. And they looked at me, they didn't know what to do. Like, they didn't know what pickup was. They didn't know how to pick teams or set their own rules and stuff like that. You know, and it's because they never played without an adult telling them, you know, what to do. You know, and I think that's the danger of, you know, starting too young and always being in organized activities is you don't learn those lessons. And, you know, like I said, when I was young, you know, I was kind of a brat, I was bossy, you know, stuff like that. But, you know, we all also learned how to, you know, argue with each other and fight and make up and, you know, take care of ourselves and stuff like that, you know, social lessons that, you know, we like to say sports teach us, but, you know, how many lessons are you learning, you know, when the coach is there and the coach settles or stops all the arguments, you know, before they happen, or, you know, they're the ones that are separating players before there's a fight, or the referee stepping in a game, you know, whatever the case may be, you know, or you've got the parents in the stands that are fighting themselves, you know. So, you know, if you don't have those environments where, you know, children are learning how to handle themselves and learn these things on their own, you know, where do they develop those lessons?
Yeah, it's so true. I think that's a really underrated piece of what unorganized sports can do. When you talk about playing driveway basketball or backyard football or sandlot baseball, I think that ability to interact with other kids and be able to solve disputes and set up rules and figure things out is a skill that I teach physical education at the elementary school level. And that's one of the things that my students 100% struggle with, is they don't know how to solve conflict on their own. They're always looking for an adult to step in and make a decision. They'll start arguing and then they'll come running to me. Hey, can you tell me I'm right and he's wrong, or vice versa, instead of that back and forth negotiation and figuring it out. And, you know, sometimes it did result in actual fighting, but you learn to be able to negotiate and figure that out, because you wanted to avoid that. And I think the other thing that it also teaches you is to stand up for yourself. When you think about the ability to call fouls, or the ability to say, hey, this is balls out of bounds, or that was, you know, that was a travel, whatever. Whereas, again, in the situations that we have today, parents are always there. Teachers are always there. A referee is always there to step in. And I think kids have lost some of that ability. And I know one of the things that you've done is you've created your Playmakers League. Can you talk a little bit about the philosophy behind that and just explain, if there's somebody out there that's listening, maybe it's a high school basketball coach, maybe it's somebody who's in the private basketball space, but just tell us a little bit about what makes a Playmakers League different and kind of how you came about putting that together and what it looks like.
Okay. So basically the mission for Playmakers is I wanted to create a platform to change the way that we develop basketball players. And so, to a certain extent, we're probably not going back to where everybody, plays basketball at recess until they're in fifth grade and then joins a fifth grade basketball team, I talked about. So, to me, I am a firm believer that, before you play in a 5-on-5 league, you should have considerable experience playing 3-on-3. And I am a firm believer that the number one way that we can improve shooting in teenagers, adults, is for children to start shooting on a lower hoop with a smaller basketball. So essentially using age-appropriate, equipment for children. I did a study when I was working on my PhD. The first study I did looked at, it was nominally about physical activity, because that's kind of what my department studied. But I also looked at different things within the game. So I looked at, I forget now, I think it was like a 10-minute 5-on-5 game versus a 10-minute 3-on-3. Again, first, the primary component was looking at the physical activity and basically the amount of vigorous physical activity between the 3-on-3 and the 5-on-5 was more or less the same. And so what we don't realize, when we think about 5-on-5, we think about running up and down the court and it's got to be, harder and more physical. But in reality, there's a lot of walking up and down the court. And with five people, when you're on offense, inevitably at least two people are standing around, at all times, potentially three or even four, are standing around watching, one person dribble. So in 3-on-3, you end up with, all three people being a little bit more active. And we kind of underestimate the intensity of change of directions versus straight line running. And so in a 3-on-3 game where you're in a, a smaller space, there's going to be typically more change of directions and more quick starts and stops than there might be in a 5-on-5 game, because, in a 5-on-5, you might run, especially if you're a post player, let's say, you're under the basket, you get a rebound, you outlet it, and you just run to the next rim, or, run rim to rim. You might be running fast and it has a certain amount of intensity there, but then you go and you stand in the post and you basically stand there for 15 seconds, let's say, shot goes up, you don't get the rebound, and you run from rim to rim, whereas in a 3-on-3 game, the distance that you're running is probably not going to be the same, but there's more short, starts and stops and changes of direction, stuff like that. So the intensity, the vigorous intensity is actually very similar between a 3-on-3 game and a 5-on-5 game. The heart rate stays elevated because there's less just kind of standing around. You get more breaks essentially in a 5-on-5 game. So that was the first part of the study. But what I was actually more interested in was how 3-on-3 changes the actual game. And so one of the things I looked at, and I think I called them ball contacts in the study I did, but it was basically looking at kind of meaningful actions on offense. So that being like kind of opportunities where you could, or I think on offense, I simply looked at touches. And so, we always talk about, in a 5-on-5 game, or, just in general, we always talk about, post players develop more slowly than guards. And, you know, I remember when I started coaching, you know, it's because post players are taller. It's because post players are uncoordinated. You know, everybody had their reasons, but nobody actually ever said, well, it's because post players don't get the ball as much. Right. Because if you watch, you know, and obviously now it's taken even more so because the game's even more, you know, guard dominated, and the possessions actually might be bouncing out a little bit because posts touch the ball so much on the 3-point line. But if you go back, you know, let's say 10 years, you know, close to when I did this study, post players, you know, in an average 5-on-5 offense, you know, your point guard's going to touch the ball every possession, right? Your best wing is going to touch the ball almost every post player might go, you know, rim to rim, you know, your point guard comes down, takes a jump shot, point guard comes down, one pass, you know, shooting guard shoots the ball, you know, you run your offense, it's a screen, you know, you bring a shooter off his dagger, pass, you know, shoot it off his dagger, you know, so you might go a couple times, a couple possessions without touching the ball, you know, and so when I looked at that, when I looked at 5-on-5 and 3-on-3, there was a definite difference between positions. So point guard, like I said, touched the ball basically every possession, significantly more than the wings, and who touched the ball significantly more than post players. In the 3-on-3 games, the differences between the three position groups was much smaller. There was still a significant difference between point guards and post players, I believe, but there wasn't a significant difference between point guards and wings and post players. So, you know, it's still not perfect. The point guard was still, and again, this was using a high school team late in the season that already kind of had established positions within, you know, the team. And so one of the things that I think is if you took a group from the beginning and didn't tell anybody, you know, who's a point guard, who's a wing, who's a post, and 3-on-3, the differences would be, there'd be very few differences between position groups. Whereas because this group had played together, you know, I mean, they'd grown up playing together, you know, everybody knew who the point guard was, everybody knew who the shooter was, you know, so they're kind of tailoring, you know, even within their 3-on-3 offense, they were kind of playing to these kind of strengths. You know, I think if it had been a group that didn't know each other, you know, the differences would have evened out even more so than they did with this group. But to me, you know, when we talk about posts, you know, that's the reason posts just don't touch the ball. Like, how do you expect, you know, if you look at let's say a 32 minute high school game and whatever, let's say there's 60 possessions on offense. And so your point guard touches the ball on all 60 possessions and your post only touches the ball on 30 of those possessions. How can you expect there? And then you do that for 30 games. How do you expect them to develop at the same rate? You know, and then you add on to it that, you know, when we're in practice, you know, a typical post practice, especially at that time, was post players just learning 1-on-0 post moves. Well, we got to work on our post moves. Okay. That never happens in a game. Like, post players never touch the ball in a game where they're going to make a 1-on-0 post move, right? So then they get in a game and they travel, and now you don't pass the ball to your post player anymore because what they worked on in practice didn't transfer because they actually had to play against a defensive player. And guards suffer some of the same thing. But for whatever reason, you know, we're more likely in practice to have guards play 1-on-1, you know, especially, you know, full court ball handling type stuff, than we are to have post play 1-on-1. You know, post workout is a mic and drill, you know, followed by block to block, you know, kind of, you know, 1-on-0 post moves, or we put a coach there with a football pad. Yeah. With a football pad. And so we're going to knock the shit out of our post players when they go up for shots. And that's how we're teaching them how to play through contact, but it doesn't matter because in a game they've already traveled. So it doesn't matter if they can play through contact. You know, I mean, I remember back like almost 15 years ago, I was working with this girl, you know, post player. She's going into like 8th, 9th grade. And I finally told her mom, I was like, look, I'm not working with your daughter by herself anymore. She knows every post move I could possibly give to her. She's got great footwork when there's no defensive player there, but watch her playing the game and she can't do it. I was like, I'm only working with her if you bring another girl to work out with her. Like, bring a teammate, bring a friend. I don't care. Pick the best player that she plays against and we'll play one-on-one. But just going against air is not going to improve her anymore. Like, she's already learned the moves. She's got good footwork. Like, she can do everything when there's no defense on her. And the mom was like, no, we want her to keep working by herself. I'm like, I kid you not, I'm not working with your daughter by herself. And so she took her to a different trainer who would do one-on-oh post moves. Because she was like, well, she doesn't know the post. I'm like, no, watch her. When there's no defense there, she can do every single post move, right? Like, but it doesn't matter because she gets in a game and she's never made that decision of what post move to use. And she's never had to do it through contact and stuff like that. Like, we need a defensive player here. But her mom knew better. So she went and found that trainer who would take the money to keep working on one-on-oh footwork.
Hey, hoopheads, we all hate ankle sprains and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com/teampricing to learn more. That's ARYSE.com.
Anyway, back to the Playmakers League. That's my belief is that if we can start players in 3-on-3, there's nothing you can do in a 5-on-5 game that you can't do in 3-on-3. There's no situation, most 5-on-5 games end up, most possessions offensively end up being, two person plays or three person plays. They're the foundation of all five person, offense. So all of that you can teach, in small sided games, you can teach that in 3-on-3 play. And so that's the basic kind of mission behind Playmakers League is to, be a platform to, change how we develop young basketball players and what the entryway is to basketball and how we, basically how we develop players and how we format leagues for players. And along with the 3-on-3, then again, like I said, is using the age appropriate size baskets and balls. Cause children shouldn't shoot 3-pointers. I'm like, well, yeah, a 9-year-old using a size 7 basketball and a 10-foot hoop shouldn't shoot a 3-pointer, but give them a size 5 basketball on a, 8.5-foot hoop. And why not? They're going to be able to shoot with decent, technique because now strength and size isn't the impediment that it is when we're using an adult basket and an adult ball. So that's kind of the mission behind it. The original idea actually came from, when I was a junior college assistant coach, I ran a AAU league. Like, I was, a typical more or less volunteer coach, making a small stipend. And so the additional way that I can make money is they allowed me to use the gym. I started an AAU league, I was in Los Angeles. So I had teams coming from, San Fernando Valley all the way down to Orange County, coming to our league at Santa Monica College, and running it on Saturdays and Sundays, I think. 8 weeks or whatever. And so when I got to the end of it and I looked at all the money that I brought in and then I looked at all my expenses, I was like, man, if I did not have to pay referees, I actually would have made decent money. So from there, I was like, well, how can I, create something where the coach actually keeps the money instead of having to pay referees, and people, You know, I know my high school when I was, that I went to when I was young, you know, they managed to keep the money by making their players, referee, And so, they basically kept the money in house. So they would keep the money, but they would also pay the players a little bit. And then the players had to use that money, to travel to camps and summer leagues and stuff like team camps and stuff like that during the summer. They used the money that they were paid to referee and stuff like that. So, but that's how, some people get around, sending all their money out to other referees is, you just have your own players referee, and then you either force them to do it and don't pay them and keep all the money for your program, or you give the money to your players and then make your players, pay for, certain things. So, so that was one of the reasons why the 3-on-3 came. I was like, well, we could easily do a 3-on-3 where my players can be, coaches and just kind of manage the baskets, as nominal referees, but not worried about, whether or not we're getting every call correct, and so that was kind of the idea is, this way you could run a league, a 3-on-3 league takes less gym time than a 5-on-5 league. You can have more players in action at the same time. And you don't have to spend all your money paying for referees. And then Mike McKay up in Canada, he did an in-house study where they ran a 3-on-3 league years ago. This was before I did my studies. This is at least a dozen years ago. And he said that what they found was in a 3-on-3 league, most of the dads went out, and met outside the gym and had coffee together and stuff. And, they kind of viewed the 3-on-3 as, it's not real basketball. So we don't have to be there yelling at our kid each possession or yelling at the referees each possession. And so they found that it was, it changed the behaviors of the coach or sorry, changed. Well, it did change the behavior of the coaches, but it changed the behavior of the parents as well. And so, you had less of the problematic behaviors that typify, a lot of 5-on-5 leagues or AAU, the kind of stereotypical AAU experience, just changing it to 3-on-3 kind of changed those behaviors again, because it's not real basketball and stuff. I remember when I ran my 5-on-5 league, like I had to bring in, we basically had to call the police on a coach because the coach was going after a referee in our league. So, like things like that, you don't have to deal with, in a 3-on-3 league typically. So all these reasons are reasons why, I developed the Playmakers League, and kind of the final reason was, when I wrote Crossover and Developing Basketball Intelligence, kind of, the earlier books that I wrote, a lot of the feedback that I got was, I love your philosophy, blah, 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 but what does this actually look like? What is it? I want more kind of, step-by-step way to do it, And so kind of Blitz Basketball was kind of the first book that I wrote. That was kind of like, okay, here's the Crossover philosophy. This is kind of exactly what I did using that philosophy with my under-9 AAU team. But Playmakers League was kind of, for a combination of Crossover and Developing Basketball Intelligence, it was kind of like, here is little practice plans, for an entire league, how to run it, how to score it, the games, et cetera, et cetera. Basically a turnkey. Cause again, I was thinking originally my target was, junior college, or small college coaches, the ones that are allowed to work with players, not so much division ones, but, they're typically lower paid, but they have a gym that they can use, which for a lot of people, that's the impediment to running their own league is getting the gym. So, if I am a junior college coach, at my school, they let me use the gym. Great. So I've got the gym. Well, what do I do? Okay. Well, I'm going to run this league. Well, I'm focused on my team. I don't want to spend all my time planning activities for 40, sixth graders. you know, and that's why, you know, the league is set out. It gives you all those plans are already taken care of, you know, so you don't have to spend time planning. You've just print out your practice plan, show up, you know, run the league. So it takes away some of the planning and the thinking and stuff like that, that would make running a separate league hard, you know, for a coach who's also trying to do a good job, you know, running their own team, you know. So those were kind of the basic ideas, like kind of the mission, you know, or the goal of the league, as well as kind of the practical ideas of why I started it.
Why do you think there's such resistance? You mentioned it a couple times of, hey, 3-on-3, that's not real basketball. Or you think about the lower basket or the smaller ball. And I grew up, my dad was, I don't know if he was ahead of his time, but he was an exercise physiologist and taught, you know, at the college level. And so from the time I was in whatever, 5-6 years old, my baskets were always lower on my driveway. So I started out with probably a basket that was 6.5 feet when I was 4 or 5 years old. And then slowly over time it went up, and I was probably, I mean, my basket on my driveway probably didn't get to 10 feet until I was 15 or 16 years old. And I was a pretty good player growing up, but my basket was always lower. And yet I think, you know, and Jason knows, and I know that there's a ton of resistance when you have baskets lower. I'll give you an example right now, Brian. We're running a camp this week, and we have some of our baskets set at 10 feet, and we have some of our baskets set at 8.5, and our grade levels are 1 through 6. So we're dealing with kids who are from 6 to 12 years old. And I had one father who came in, and I know the guy, and we're talking, and he says to me, oh, I see the baskets are low here. My son's not going to like that. You know, and his, you know, again, his son's a pretty good player. You know, he's whatever, he's probably 11 years old. And, you know, there's that resistance out there that, oh, if they're shooting at a lower basket, we're hindering them because eventually they're going to have to play on a 10-foot basket, or they can't spend all this time playing 3-on-3 because that's not how the quote real game is played. So in your mind, how do we educate? I think this is the biggest challenge that we face when it comes to youth basketball is how do we educate parents when it comes to some of these things that are clear, the research that you've done, the just thinking about it logically, it just makes so much more sense. But yet there's so many people that are resistant to it. How do we overcome that and educate people about the value of a lower basket, a smaller basketball, 3-on-3, small-sided games versus throwing a bunch of 7-year-olds on a 94-foot court where all they're doing is just running in between the two tops of the keys and they're not really developing their skills? How do we educate people? What's your thought on that?
Well, the most effective that I've seen is the examples where they, in different sports, they force the parents to play on, you know, with equipment or on, you know, size of courts or whatever, that would be kind of the same dimension proportional to what their children are playing on when they're playing on, you know, 10-foot hoops. So if you're, you know, basically making, you know, the parents try shooting on 13 or 14 foot hoops, you know, or, you know, playing on, you know, courts that are, you know, 150, you know, feet long and stuff, you know, shooting 3-pointers, you know, from 30 feet, you know, or 35 feet, like when they can see that and they can understand, oh, this is, you know, proportionally, this is what we're asking children to do. I think that's the most effective way, because clearly me talking about it's having no effect, you know, as well as other people. You know, I know I'm certainly not the only person who's ever said that we should play, you know, 3-on-3 basketball or use smaller baskets. But, you know, so just talking about it, you know, doing research, you know, I mean, on the Playmakers League website, I mean, I've on the side, there's links and there's, you know, probably a dozen different studies, you know, that look at modifications to youth sports. But I think I've pretty much just got the basketball ones on the website. But, you know, in terms of how it affects enjoyment, how it affects skill development, how it affects motivation, all the things that really is what we want to develop. Like when we're talking about a third grader playing basketball, Like, we shouldn't really be concerned, you know, what the actual 3-point percentage on a 10-foot hoop is. What we should be concerned is, you know, are they enjoying the experience? Is it increasing their motivation to continue? Are the players coming back next year? You know, are they learning skills that they can continue to develop as they, you know, mature? You know, and I mean, that's essentially part of the problem, you know, is we look at each kind of age group as, you know, the children are finished products for that year. And so, you know, if in that case, you know, we need, you know, to play on the 10 foot hoop, you know, or whatever. So, you know, we look at the specifics of sports instead of understanding, kind of the general movements, that underlie the sports and how learning the proper movements will transfer as players mature, as opposed to, you know, I mean, realistically, if you're talking about third grader, you don't want a third grader to master a third grade shot at a 10 foot basket, because that shot's not going to work when they're in high school. Cause they're going to, you know, it's the story of Steph Curry, you know, he shot too low. You know, and so his dad finally at some point in his high school, I believe, told him, look, if you're going to play, you know, in college and beyond, we've got to, you know, raise your shot a little bit, you know, it's the same thing. Like if you master shooting threes as a third grader on a 10 foot hoop, some point in your life, you're going to have to change your shot. Whereas if you master shooting threes on an 8.5 foot hoop with a size 5 basketball, your shot's not going to have to change that much. Obviously, you know, when you move to a bigger ball, when you move to a bigger basket, you're going to have that, you know, initial adaptation, but you have that initial adaptation anyway, because if you're, you know, 4'8", you know, as a third, you know, whatever, let's say fifth grader, I don't know how tall kids are. And then, you know, you go through a growth spurt and you come back next year and you're 5'5", like you're adapting, like you're relearning your coordination. And so, you know, that's why this obsession with being, well, we have to be so specific. We have to use the adult size, because they have to learn how to shoot on a 10-foot hoop. It's like, yeah, but your 4'8" third grader, who's a 5'5" fourth grader, that's like a new person. You know, it's not the same person playing next season. And when they're a 6-foot ninth grader, they're a new person again. Like it's not the same thing. 8 or 9 inch growth spurt from year to year, you're going to be uncoordinated for a while, you know, whereas if you're, you know, just kind of growing an inch or two, you know, year by year, you're that readaptation, that relearning of your just basic coordination. I'm not even talking about shooting a basketball, just basically moving, squatting, jumping, landing, you know, all these things, you know, essentially, if you grow 5 inches in a year, you almost have to relearn all those skills. And then you have to relearn the sports skills on top of that, have that new coordination. And so, I mean, things like this, you know, we just, as just a general population, we just don't understand these things. What we understand is, well, basketball is played on a 10-foot hoop, so I have to play on a 10-foot hoop. You know, basketball is played 5-on-5, so I have to play 5-on-5, because that's what makes sense. If I want, because we think of learning as being specific, right? If I want to learn to play 5-on-5, I have to play 5-on-5. But what we miss is, the 5-on-5 that we're playing really has very little to do with the 5-on-5 that we want to play when we reach a high school level or college level, right? The the shooting on a 10-foot hoop when we're in third grade has almost nothing to do with the shooting that we want to do, you know, when we're, you know, in ninth or 12th grade or in college or whatever. And so we're focusing on the wrong things instead of focusing on trying to have, you know, proportional or age appropriate equipment, so that as our body matures, we change the equipment to stay in general proportion to our body. And so we never get too far away from that general, you know, proportion. You know, we focus on the absolute specifics, you know? And so, you know, if we can think of things in terms of proportions instead of thinking in terms of absolute specifics, I mean, that's, you know, from, I guess, from a mathematical standpoint, that's how you convince people, but nobody wants to think about math or do math. So that's not going to work. I talked about this. I talked about this with an NBA coach, you know, last week or the week before, you know, and, you know, we talked about, and I know some other people have talked about it, you know, potentially with 3-on-3 being in the Olympics and getting a lot more publicity, you know, potentially that's going to change things. And now, you know, people will actually view 3-on-3 as real basketball, since you can actually win a gold medal in the Olympics doing it. Short of that, you know, like I said, the best way to me is getting the ridiculous baskets out there and just demonstrating and not trying to talk through it, but just showing, like, this is essentially what you're asking your kid to do. Like, can you make, you know, with a basketball that's bigger than a size 7 ball, you know, shooting on a, you know, 14, 15 foot hoop, can you make a shot from 30 feet? You know, there are very few adults who can do that. You know, like, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, NBA players can, you know, but your average out of shape, you know, dad bod is not going to be able to make, you know, a shot from 30 feet on, like, you know, I mean, it's like throwing a medicine ball, you know, like, and then you're like, see, that's what you're asking. When you're telling your son to shoot from 20 feet on a 10 foot hoop with a size 7 basketball, that's what you're asking him to do. Like, all right, well, I guess that makes sense. Maybe I shouldn't be asking him to do that. You know, I just think, like, doing things works better than, you know, talking about it. Cause clearly, like I said, talking and research and all that, you know, hasn't had much of an effect. I think it also comes down to, you know, like, what's the basic motivation? Like, why are you signing up your son or daughter to play sports? You know, and most people initially will say, well, you know, I just want my son or daughter, I just want them to have a good experience. I want them to learn. I want them to, you know, meet some friends, have fun, blah, blah, blah. But then you get to that first game, and now we're, you know, batshit crazy, and we've got to win every game, and my kid's got to get up more shots, and, you know, yada, yada, you know. And so, you know, if we can take those initial reasons why we sign up for sports and say all those things are better served in a small-sided game and 3-on-3 on a age-appropriate basket, like, what do kids like doing? They like shooting, right? How are they going to make more shots? They like scoring. How are, you know, I mean, you go to a second or third grade basketball game and the games are, you know, in single digits. Like, what's the point? You know, put them on an appropriate size hoop. And now all of a sudden you see kids that can do things. Like, that's fun. You know, that's what kids actually want to do. They want to be able to do things. They want to be able to learn. They want to be able to put the ball in the basket because, you know, everybody realizes at the end of the day, that's the point of the game. And so, you know, if I go out, you know, and we play for, you know, a 32-minute game and we've got 12 points at the end of it, you know, versus we play a 32-minute game, you know, and we've got 40 points, like, scoring 40 points is more fun, you know, and more kids get to, you know, that team that scored 12 points is probably two people scoring. You know, you got the biggest kid on the team is probably scoring most of the points, and then maybe some other player, you know, makes a lucky shot. You know, whereas if you're scoring 40, you're probably getting 5 or 6 kids putting the ball in the basket. That's more fun for them. You know, they enjoy it more. And if they enjoy it more, they're going to want to play more. They're going to want to practice more on their own. They're going to want to sign up for the team next year. And ultimately, at the youngest ages, those are the things that are most important, because you can't develop into a great professional basketball player, or high school basketball player, or college basketball player, if you quit when you're in fourth grade, because it's not fun. Or, you know, because you can't make a shot because, you know, you're the smallest player on the court and you're using a adult basketball and a 10-foot hoop and you're just not strong enough to put the ball in the basket. So nobody wants to pick you on their team. They don't put you in the game, et cetera, et cetera. So you quit. Like, you're never going to be a professional player, or a high school player, or a college player if you quit playing when you're fourth grade, you know. But we know that, you know, by the age of 13, most players have dropped out of sports, and supposedly it's getting closer to 11 to 12. The 13-year-old always made some sense, because there's going to be natural attrition when you move, you know, even in the, you know, my generation, our generation, when you move from, middle school sports to high school sports, there's going to be that natural attrition because, you know, not everybody's going to be a three sport athlete anymore. You know, kids are, you know, teams are going to be competitive and you're going to have to cut teams and stuff like that. I mean, you know, my high school, you know, I think my freshman year, you know, 110, 115 players tried out for the freshman team, you know, and my high school got tired of cutting that many players. So we actually had two freshman teams, but that still means you're cutting 70 players, you know? So they're dropping out of the sport, not because they didn't want to play anymore, but because there's not a competitive team for them anymore. So those statistics always made sense to me, but you know, these days, you know, kids are starting to drop out before that, you know, kind of transition to high school. You know, and typically the reason why children give for dropping out of sports is not fun. Why is it not fun? Well, one reason is because it's they can't do the things that they see on TV because the basket's too high, the ball is too big for them, you know. And then part of it is, you know, the environment that we create as coaches and as parents that make it, you know, too competitive too soon. You know, there's a host of other reasons, you know, I mean, playing time, you know, you signed up because your friend is playing and now your friend decides to play baseball. So you go play baseball. Like, you know, there's obviously, you know, a ton of reasons. Nothing in sports or in life ever boils down to one single thing, but these are things that are actually within our control. You know, we can have leagues, you know, that use age appropriate equipment. I met with a YMCA or a Parks and Rec years ago, you know, about I wanted to offer. I was like, hey, I want to run Playmakers League. You know, let's scrap your third grade, you know, 5-on-5 league, and let's play through. Let's make a Playmakers League. And he's like, I talked to him, and he actually admitted, year to year, 50% of the kids in their league quit. They did not come back the next year. But he refused to try something different because he said all he had to do to keep his boss happy was keep whatever 100 players signing up every year. So that means, you know, if 50 players quit, he just needs to find a new 50 players to fill in. And then those 50 quit the next year, he just needs to find another 50 years. As long as they kept 100 players, you know, enrolled, he kept his job, everybody was happy, right? 50% of the players from year to year, and he refused to try something different. Like, what if kids actually liked it better and nobody quit? And now next year you have 150 players because you got those same 50 that you brought in to replace the other 50, but you also kept everybody in the game, right? Wouldn't your boss be happy that you've improved? You know, you've added, you know, 50 players to your league, you know, like, but no, he was so worried about keeping his job and the fact that, you know, parents are, you know, he gave the, well, parents are going to say it's not real basketball and they're used to 5-on-5 and my coaches want to do it this way and I'll lose my coaches and blah, blah, blah. And so he wouldn't even try something different. Like, even on the side, like, you wouldn't even give, like, well, we'll run like your league 2 days and we'll run 5-on-5 2 days and we'll, you know, see who has the most kids, you know, return next year. You know, he wouldn't even like, you know, and so that's the hesitancy is, you know, and I mean, it's like anything in life, change is hard, you know, even if you're getting suboptimal results, it's often easier to continue getting those suboptimal results than to risk getting even worse. You know, I mean, that's why a lot of coaches are hesitant to change players, you know, shots in their teenage years. They're like, well, I know he only makes 30% of his shots, but what if I mess around with it? Now he makes 25%, you know, without thinking, well, what if he makes 40 or 50%? Now you've got a player on your hands, you know, but it's better, you know, do no harm. So, you know, we resist change even when everything is telling us that change is absolutely necessary. If you know, I mean, what business can last losing 50% of your customers year to year, right? Like, you know, but it's easier to stay with a no. Well, I know I can get more kids and they're going to sign up and we'll stay at 100 from year to year than to actually try something new.
I think the most important point that you made there is the fact that so many kids, when you think about the game of basketball specifically and what attracts anyone to the game, it's throwing the ball through the basket. You know what I mean? It's making baskets. And Jason and I were actually just talking about this today at basketball camp and looking at the games that were played at lower baskets and how many more kids are brought into the game that can now make shots and can participate, where on a 10-foot basket, they just can't participate. And I think to go along with that, one of the things that I find disturbing slash interesting, depending upon your perspective, is the number of facilities that are theoretically designed for kids that don't even have the ability to have a basket that isn't 10 feet. I know my gym at the elementary school where I teach, we have 10-foot baskets that are permanently anchored. There's no ability for me other than to bring in a portable basket to have a lower basket. Sure. And I think just, you know, you start looking at the people that are making decisions, and it's just, it's a challenge, and it's an educational piece, and there's an institutional piece to it. But I think if we could figure it out and we could get people to give it a shot, I don't think there's any kid who would say, hey, it's not more fun to play on a lower basket where I actually have a chance of making more baskets and playing, like you said, a game that's 40-38 instead of a game that's 8-7. It's just, right. It's just more fun to watch the ball go in the basket. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
When you think about, I wanted to ask you a little bit about making, teaching kids how to make decisions on a basketball floor, and how too often as coaches, we think that by teaching the technique of the game that we're helping the player to really improve themselves. Whereas really it's a combination, as you said, there's a difference between technique and skill. So just maybe talk a little bit about your philosophy there in terms of teaching kids to apply the technique with the decision-making within the confines of the actual game.
Yeah. I mean, when we watch a game, it's easy to dissociate, you know, from a cognitive perspective, it's easy to dissociate and say, oh yeah, well, I can isolate that skill and just practice that skill without any defensive player there. And then I'll get better at that. And then that will make me better in a game. Right. 'Cause that's kind of how we learn in other areas of our life. Right. And to me, that's one reason why I don't like to, you know, I say I'm a coach. I don't believe in that. Well, I'm a teacher on a basketball court. No, I am a coach. I coach, like, and I don't think that's less than, like, I think sometimes coaches, you know, we think of coaching as being less than being an academic teacher or something like that. So we want to prove that we're, you know, as good as, so no, I'm a teacher, you know, and the hardwood is my classroom and stuff like that. And so, you know, I'm a coach, and I think, you know, learning a motor skill, especially in a team game, an invasion sport, it's different than other things. It's why I don't like when we try to compare, you know, hitting a golf ball to shooting a basketball or throwing a dart, you know, or playing the piano or the violin or all these things that, you know, we try to generalize the research from these areas or what we see in these areas and say, well, the learning would be the same in basketball because learning's learning, but it's not, you know, like defense changes everything. And so, you know, using shooting as the example, because that's typically the hardest one with which to convince people, you know, my friend Harry Mannin from Finland says that, you know, that there's no such thing as an uncontested shot, right? Once you're in a game, there's defense. Now, they may not be very close to you. You know, you might be wide open, you know, judged by, you know, whatever the standards are for being wide open. you know, whatever, it's 6 or more feet, I think, in the NBA is considered wide open, you know, the way that they do their stats. But there's still a defensive player there, right? And so just having that player, even if that player is 8, 9 feet away from me, when I catch that ball, I have a decision to make. You know, I have to decide, you know, is this the appropriate shot for my team at this point? Does a teammate have a better shot? Am I wide open? Do I have time to get my shot off? You know, is there a better shot for my team? If I, you know, pass up this shot and drive, you know, can I create all these things? And just the simple fact of having to make these decisions changes the execution of the skill. Now, when you actually put a defensive player, you know, close to you within 6 feet, you know, whether you consider it an open shot, which I think is 3 to 6 feet, or you shoot considered a contested shot, you know, inside of 3 feet, just the presence of that defensive player is going to change the actual biomechanics of shooting. So if you shoot in an empty gym by yourself, and then you shoot with a player somewhere within 6 feet of you, the actual biomechanics of your shot change, right? So typically, you know, you're going to shoot a little bit faster, and you're going to release it a little bit higher or a little bit, you know, or a little bit quicker, right? Because even if that player's, you know, 6 feet away, you have that concern that if you take too much time, you know, they're going to be able to close that distance and contest your shot. So if, as has been shown repeatedly, your shot changes with a defensive player presence there, just the biomechanics, again, not even talking about the decision component part, you know, how much does the isolated practice actually transfer to the game shooting? You know, and we've accepted this idea, you know, that there's game slippage and, you know, you've got to shoot 90% in practice to shoot 40% in games. And that's just standard. And, you know, big name trainers say it, so everybody believes it, you know, but to me, why do we have to assume that, you know, you're going to shoot half as well during games as you are in practice? And to me, the answer is because you're not practicing the same thing. You're not practicing what's, you know, the skill that's being used in a game. And even if you're only shooting open shots in a game, you know, so obviously, you know, there's going to be, you know, in a game, there's some things you can never replicate in practice. So there's always going to be, you know, a little bit of slippage, right? Even though we always say that, you know, we want to, you know, practice harder so the game is easier, you know, and the game, you know, coaches and players love to say that the game should be easier than practice. It's like, well, if the game's easier than practice, you know, why are you shooting half as well? You know, if the game's actually easier than practice, you should have a better shooting percentage in the game than you do in practice. You know, the backdrop's going to be different, all those things. You know, you don't practice with, you know, 20,000 fans, you know, screaming as you shoot the ball. You know, you can't possibly simulate the end of game pressure that you feel in the playoffs. Like, all of these things, you know, are going to affect shooting, but they shouldn't affect it to create a 50% drop, you know, in shooting percentage. And so the things that we can control are how we make decisions, you know, shot selection and, you know, shooting and learning how to shoot with defense. But typically we look at and say, well, we just need to get better at our technique and that'll transfer and we'll shoot better in games. You know, we shoot 80-90% in practice and we go in games and we shoot 30%. We wonder why. It's because we're not practicing the same thing. That simple decision, even when it's an open shot, that simple decision affects how I'm going to shoot the ball. You know, and then obviously, you know, making passes, making the decision of when to drive, you know, how far to drive, you know, trying to draw a second defender to make the pass, okay, you know, the second defender isn't all the way in front of me, so I'm going to finish, you know, all these things, you know, it's easier to see, you know, how we need to practice against defense to develop these things, right? But for some reason, you know, like, you know, even, you know, I've had dinners with really good coaches. Like, I buy into everything that you're saying, except I still think that we need tons of isolated shooting practice. That's the only way to become a better shooter. Like, but it's not, you know, I mean, obviously with, you know, depending on the age, you know, there's differences, you know, a third grader probably needs, you know, some isolated practice, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, NBA players probably can get more out of isolated practice than your average high school or college player. And you probably have to manage the load. So having them shoot a ton of, you know, contested game speed, you know, make decision type shots, you know, in workouts, especially during the season, probably isn't realistic and probably isn't beneficial, right? Because that's one of the other things that I think that I've talked about a couple of times, but that I don't think we fully grasp, is when we make this transition that a lot of us are making, and we go from doing a lot of kind of the standard drills, the isolated drills, you know, et cetera, into being more kind of constraints led coaching or doing a lot more small sided games and doing a lot more, you know, competitive drills during practice. Not only is it more, you know, typically more physically taxing to do these, but we underestimate the mental load involved in making decisions on every single possession in practice. So if I'm doing a typical shooting drill, you know, let's say I'm just doing a, you know, a 5x5 spot shooting drill, you know, I'm going to make five shots in the corner that I'm going to move tonight. Like, I can zone out, right? You know, I'm just up there, I'm relaxed, I'm shooting, somebody's rebounding, pass me the ball. I don't have to think about anything. I'm just zoned out in my rhythm, you know, just shooting the ball, right? Nice and easy. There's very little, you know, mental load involved in that drill, right? Two things then, you know, in a game, I can't get in that kind of rhythm, right? I'm not going to shoot five shots in a row, bang, 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 bang. You know, if I get five shots from the same area in an entire game, I'm lucky, you know, and that's not even counting, you know, the amount of defensive pressure, speed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Let's just say that I'm, you know, playing on a team where my whole role is just stand in the corner and shoot, you know, when I catch the ball, you know, I might get five or six of those the entire game, right? Whereas in that drill, I'm bang, bang, bang. So the rhythm with which I'm shooting in that drill is not going to be the same. I can never have that same kind of rhythm in a game. So there's another difference between the practice and the games that accounts for differences in the shooting percentages. But just in terms of the mental load, if I try to do the same, you know, let's say a similar type drill where I'm trying to make 25 shots, but I've got on every time I've got a passing option, you know, and I've got a defensive player closing out, and I've got to make the decision. Do I have a better shot? Does my teammate have a better shot? Even in a simple drill like that, you know, where the decision should be pretty easy, is a closeout taking away an open shot. Okay, my teammate's got a better shot. Is a closeout too far away from me? I've got an easy shot. That's a fairly simple, you know, decision. I only have to read one thing, right? There's still mental load there. And if we're doing that every repetition, every drill in practice, we're creating a lot more total fatigue than we realize. And so, like I say, in a NBA, you know, situation, you know, where we're already looking at how much load, you know, these guys have and the injuries that are happening, you know, just from the games with, you know, I mean, I know most of these teams, you know, that are having the injuries, you know, are barely practicing and have been barely practicing, you know, for months now, you know, so, you know, trying to say, okay, well, you know, we're going to get you game ready. So we're going to do a bunch of contested, you know, decision-making shooting. It's probably not realistic, right? So obviously, you know, there's a spectrum, you know, and I understand this. But from a general standpoint, high school player, you know, off-season workouts, stuff like that, you know, we always talk about game shots. You know, we want to take game shots, game speeds, game spots, right? But those really the constraints that most affect shooting percentages, in my opinion, are the defense, you know, and that decision to shoot more so even than the speed or the distance. You know, obviously the distance has something to play, you know, some effect. You know, you're going to shoot better on layups than you do on three-pointers, right? But, you know, making that decision, you know, I mean, you if you really watch players closely, especially players, you know, that you've worked with over a period of time, so you can kind of, you know, understand how they play and stuff like that. Like, you can see where they're kind of second guessing themselves on a shot, or, you know, they're catching the ball and they're not 100% sure as they're going up for their shot, or, you know, you can kind of see their eye divert to see like they're going up to shoot, but then they're not sure, you know, maybe that player cutting the basket, maybe they should be making that pass to the cutter, you know, all of these things are going to affect shooting percentage. And if you only shoot in isolated practice and without defense and without these choices and without these decisions, you know, in practice, they're going to affect your percentages more than if you shoot in these situations, you know, during practice. And so, you know, that's why to me, you know, again, within reason, because, you know, I do think you have to manage the physical and the, you know, the mental fatigue, but within reason, I think there should be an offense and a defense, you know, in every drill, right? And I think, you know, this is how you start to develop the decision-making in players, right? You know, I was you know, talking about that with a coach the other day. Like, we were going back and forth talking about how, you know, coaches will basically instruct their players as though they're robots in practice, and then they complain that they play like robots in games, right? You know, so as soon as a mistake happens in practice, you stop it. You don't let them work through the mistake. Well, how are they supposed to learn how to make the next play in a game if every time they make a mistake in practice, you stop the action? Or if you're telling them, you know, okay, you know, X to Y to Z, like that's the drill, like X to Y to Z. You know, and I see college coaches that they – you know, they call that a decision-making drill. I'm like, no, you're telling the player what to do. Just because you stand there with a hand up, but you're telling them to shoot over your hand, that they're not making a decision. Like, to make a decision, they have to have the actual choice of, you know, shooting the ball or not shooting the ball, you know, shooting the ball or passing the ball. And so even if you're doing a defended shooting drill, like, you know, like one of our warm-up drills, you know, just basic partner shooting, but we'll close out, you know, just put a little bit of pressure, right? You know, there's no decision there. I mean, we ultimately add the decision, but, you know, initially, you know, I'm telling you, if you catch the ball, you're shooting, okay? I've made the decision, right? That player hasn't made the decision to shoot. They know if they catch the ball, they're shooting, right? And so then, you know, we will generally add, okay, well, if the closeout is taking away your shot, don't take a bad shot, you know, that's where, and then we practice, you know, our mid-range pull-ups there. So, okay, if the closeout's too close, it takes away your shot. Okay, then we're going to dribble into a pull-up. But still, I'm telling them what shot to shoot, right? So there's a small decision judging the closeout, whether or not I have space to shoot or not. But really, the coach is making most of those decisions, right? I'm telling them on a catch, if you're open, you shoot it. If not, you dribble into mid-range, right? So it's limited. And so again, that's kind of the beginning process of learning to make decisions, you know, and then you would load even more. Now you put a third player in the drill, so they've got the passing option, right? And then you put the fourth player, so now you have two defensive players, you know, and so you build like that. And that's how, you know, whether you're talking about shot selection, whether you're talking about, you know, a two-on-one fast break, whether you're talking about, you know, whether to finish at the rim or make the pass out, all these things, you know, to me, that's basically, you know, how you do it. You know, you start, you know, initially, you know, kids have to learn the basics, you know, so, you know, they have to, you know, learn a little bit of what's a layup, you know, what's a pass, et cetera, you know, so you have a little bit of undefended, you know, practice, but But the goal should be to get beyond that undefended practice as quickly as possible. And also to realize that you can always regress a drill. You don't always have to progress. So, you know, if I, you know, and like with teams, it generally doesn't happen because I'm, you know, I'm aware of my team and what their abilities are. So I can pretty much target where we want to start, you know, but like at camps, I might go into a camp and think players are going to be, you know, at level five. And then we start. So I start with, you know, let's say a level five drill. And so let's say I'm going to skip, you know, basic layups. We're going to go straight to, you know, kind of defended layups. And then I start watching, oh, well, yeah, we need to step it back to level three. We're not ready for level five. Let's do a little bit of work on layups, and let's talk about what are different kind of layups that we could use so that we're not getting called for charges every time. And we're not just, you know, taking the ball straight to a bigger player and putting it right into their hands. What are the options? You know, if that player is beating you to the spot, you know, if the player is already there, if it's a help player versus a player on your back, like what are the different shots that we can take, you know, and let's try those a couple times without that player. Okay. Now we're going to put that defensive player back in. Okay. And now that we've done some work where you know, you're shooting the ball, it's just a matter of making the choice of which shot, right? So that's a fairly simple decision. Well, now we're going to have that second defensive player, right? And so now you've got it. Well, do you stop and shoot a jump shot before you get to the defender? Or, you know, do you go all the way and create contact for a finish? And then we're going to have that second offensive player. Well, now as you're going in, if you draw that help defender, now you've got that passing option. So instead of you taking a contested shot, that might be a good shot depending on your skill level. Now you're going to make the pass, you know, potentially for a great shot. You know, or maybe they're just going to hedge and they're going to recover. So really you need to keep the ball and make the layup yourself. And so, you know, and then you add the third and the fourth and fifth. And that's to me how, again, regardless of the skill, you know, offensively or defensively, you know, it you start with the simple ones, you know, and you progress it. And then if we progress it, you know, to where we're not successful, then we're going to regress it a little bit, and then we're going to progress it again. And it's this, you know, kind of continuum or spectrum that we want to work on, you know, and most of the time is spent somewhere in the middle. We don't spend a lot of time on the undefended isolated practice, but we also don't spend a ton of time, you know, again, depending on level, in the full 5-on-5, you know, a level, you know, most, because you're not going to get as many repetitions there. You know, most of the time is spent, you know, making that initial decision, making, you know, the initial play and then the pass, you know, these kind of things, and, you know, doing it in, you know, 2-on-2, 3-on-3, 4-on-4, those kind of situations are going to best allow for that, because you're going to hit that sweet spot in terms of the difficulty and the complexity of the skill, the game representativeness of the skill, but also maximizing the number of repetitions the players get for the skill, you know, that you might not be able to get in a 5-on-5 situation, you know. And as a coach, you can control the action a little bit better in a 2-on-2 or 3-on-3. So you can constrain the drill, constrain the game to focus on the skills that you want to focus on better than you can in a 5-on-5 game. So, you know, for those of you, so, you know, to get back to the basic question of how do you build in decision-making, basically, you know, to me, that's what you do. You know, you want to extend your players, you want to find out where they are, and then you want to extend them, and then you want to push them a little further. And when you push too far, then you want to come back and you want to keep them so that they're successful most of the time, you know, but they shouldn't be successful all the time. Because if they're successful all the time, they're not really learning anything new. You know, they're just doing something that they can already do, you know? And so there's, you know, I got the equation from a Gary Klein book, you know, that there's basically improvement comes from two ways. You can either reduce mistakes or you can increase options or increase creativity, right? So, you know, in terms of making layups, I can get better so that I make, you know, 100% of my traditional right-handed layups. And that's one way to improve. But another way that I can improve is to be able to shoot a reverse layup, an inside hand layup, you know, a goofy foot layup, you know, all these different shots. Every time I add a new layup to my repertoire, that's also improvement. And so too often in practice, we focus on reducing mistakes and not enough time on increasing the creativity or increasing options or increasing ways that we can exploit the situations.
Ryan, that is great stuff. I feel like, honestly, we've touched on like 5% of what we could have gone into. This has been tremendously informative. We can't thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to join us tonight. Before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to share where people can connect with you, whether that's social media, email, website. Just give us where people can find out more about you, connect with you, and then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Okay, yeah. Probably Twitter is the best. At Brian McCormick on Twitter. You know, if you just message me, whatever, reply or at me or whatever, you know, I'll respond. And you know, I'll just send you my number to contact me. You know, I have 180shooter.com and playmakersleague.com websites. I've been told the Playmakers website, the contact form often doesn't go through. It always works whenever I try to do it. So I struggle to figure out the mistake, and how to fix it. But I do know a lot of people have struggled with it. So if you try it and I don't respond, like I generally respond, you know, within a day or so, you know, if I'm traveling, I'll respond a little bit less quickly to that just because I don't check that email as much, unless I have my laptop with me. But, you know, so if I don't respond, you know, within a day, it means I missed something or I'm out of town or traveling or something. And it's best to hit me on Twitter, you know, and I'll reach out that way.
Fantastic. Brian, again, can't thank you enough for spending some time with us. Definitely, like I said, I feel like we left a lot on the table, and maybe there'll be an opportunity at some point in the future to bring you back on and talk more about some of the things that you've talked about in all your books. And if you have a chance, people out there in our audience, if you get a chance to pick up one of Brian's books, I'd highly recommend that. You can just search him on Amazon as an author and a bunch of his stuff will come up. It's really, really excellent material for coaches.
I also tagged it on our Twitter thing. So it's there. The link is on their Twitter.
Mike. Awesome.
Hey, you're there.
I'm here. I'm here.
Jason's still alive, Brian. He's still alive over there. So again, thank you. Really appreciate it. And everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.